Engineering News, the most widely read publication in biotechnology, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling talks to Dr. Dennis O'Rourke from the University of Utah about anthropological genetics, its impact on human population studies, and its potential influence on drug development.
Dr. Dennis O'Rourke is a professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Utah. He received his PhD from the University of Kansas in 1980 and was trained in genetic epidemiology. He has gone on to specialize in population and evolutionary genetics and quantitative methods. Dr. O'Rourke is the president of the American Association of Anthropological Genetics. Dr. O'Rourke, what is an anthropological geneticist?
Well, there are probably lots of definitions depending on who you ask. To me, an anthropological geneticist, or the field of anthropological genetics, is an area where we use genetic methods and analytical approaches to help clarify and understand something about the nature of human variation and human adaptability, everything from understanding more fully and in greater detail regional population histories to the dispersal of the human species to human adaptation and disease risk, but always using genetic methods and approaches to address those kinds of questions.
Now, a number of magazine and journal articles have pointed out that genetics has transformed the field of anthropology over the past decade or so. How has modern genetics changed the study of anthropology?
Well, I think it's done so in a number of ways. It has simply brought an analytical dimension that had been present, but in what today we might think of as a more rudimentary form earlier, particularly the bringing the power of the molecular revolution of the 1980s to anthropology has been, I think, tremendously important, and it's had an impact in several areas within the field of anthropology, especially in biological anthropology, but also archaeology. If nothing else, just providing the very large numbers of polymorphic markers that are now available to us so that we can more reliably assess population relationships, colonization events, ancestral descendant relationships, things that we certainly did in earlier years, but we have much greater power to make those kind of inferences and connections now. But in other areas as well, the use of molecular genetic data, for example, has been brought to bear on paleoanthropological questions, the role of Neanderthals in human evolution, the sequencing of mitochondrial DNA in prehistoric populations, and assessing similarity and differences between Neanderthals and moderns. We now have the capability in populations of primates to assess kinship and assess how kinship plays into patterns of behavioral diversity in various species of interest to anthropologists. And of course, I'm a little biased because I'm an ancient DNA specialist, but the use of molecular methods to identify species that have been recovered in archaeological context in order to study resource utilization and adaptation in prehistoric populations. I think in all of these ways, the use of molecular methods and genetic methods have enhanced what anthropologists have been interested in for a long time.
Now, picking up on this theme a bit, in an article in The American Anthropologist, you noted that genetic methods have had a long history in anthropology, going back to the 1960s and 1970s. Would you talk about the genetic studies that were typically carried out back then, and how does this compare to genetic research taking place today?
Well, in many ways it's similar, but in some important ways it's rather different. It's true, the 60s and 70s, in my view at least, were really the heyday of classical marker studies, use of blood groups, HLA types, serum proteins, enzymes, those kinds of markers were available to us in the 1960s and 70s, and those kinds of classical markers were used to try to infer population histories, study population structure, the use of genetic distance statistics, things of that nature. I would point out that those kind of studies actually go much further back than the 60s and 70s, World War I era, and even in North America, studies were beginning in the 1930s. So there's a very long history in anthropology of using genetic data for these kinds of population genetic questions. The difference now is that we have such a broader array of markers, from mitochondrial DNA sequencing, Y chromosome markers, SNPs, STRs, indels, a whole variety of different types of markers that give us different windows into the past. We're often addressing the same kinds of questions that anthropological geneticists were interested in earlier years, but the power of the nature of the data gives us so much greater power and specificity. We can ask more precise questions about human history and human adaptability and human population movement than we could with the classical markers of years ago. But in many ways, the approach is the same. Visiting communities, talking to people, learning about population history, family histories, genealogies, requesting participation and donation of samples so that we can begin to construct a genetic history of populations.
Now, what have been a few of the major discoveries about human evolution, variation, and migration that have only been possible with the use of these new genetic technologies?
Well, the first example that comes to mind, and again, it may be part of my bias, is the sequencing of Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA that I mentioned just a moment ago. How that has affected our view of the relationship of Neanderthals to modern populations of humans, I think, has been fairly profound. We now have mitochondrial data of one sort or another on at least a half dozen different Neanderthal samples, and it's become very clear that they're all very similar, but collectively they're also very different from anatomically modern humans, far more different than anatomically moderns are from each other. We also have similar sequence data from early anatomically moderns in Europe, dating to 20 to 25,000 years ago, and it's clear that they're indistinguishable from modern populations and equally different from the Neanderthals. So I think it's, in some sense, that the new molecular methods that have been brought to bear on Neanderthals have reinforced that the anatomical or morphological distinctiveness of Neanderthals is reflected in at least that part of their genome as well. And it's led, I think, most to understand that if Neanderthals had any contribution to the modern gene pool, it was probably very little, and some would argue perhaps none at all. And it's changed the way we've thought about that evolutionary dynamic in Europe. And I think the same might be said for the way in which we now think about the dispersal of Homo sapiens out of Africa at an earlier time. The nature of genetic data has refined the way we have thought about the timing and the nature of that that event.
Now, this sort of leads to my next question, and you've sort of answered this already. I assume that some genetic studies have confirmed or reinforced knowledge already gained through traditional anthropological research, such as archaeology and cultural anthropology, while others have probably overturned long-held beliefs. You were just talking about Neanderthal. There have been debates for years whether they were extensions of the human lineage or something completely different, and you just answered that. Are there any other examples where current genetic research has sort of changed the old paradigm or old belief system of things that were accepted in anthropology and which were obtained through archaeological or cultural anthropological methods?
Well, I can't think of any good examples where it's completely overturned what we thought we knew. I think what has more typically been the case is we've just given greater specificity and a refinement to what we thought we knew before. I can speak most clearly to my own work and the work of my students. Archaeologists, for example, had determined that in the prehistory of the eastern Arctic, there was an early population, sometimes called Paleo-Eskimo, usually referred to as Dorset in the eastern Arctic, and that they had been replaced by a different people, a different culture, called the Thule, about 1,000 years ago, give or take, and that the Thule are the immediate ancestors of modern Inuit populations. We have looked at ancient DNA data for some, not a huge sample, but some of these early Dorset Thule individuals, and it does seem pretty clear that the Thule and Dorset are genetically very distinct, very different. There was a migration and a replacement event, just as archaeologists had determined from traditional archaeological data, but we were able to show that there clearly had to have been some sort of admixture, at least in some cases, in some locations, so it gave a little bit of a nuanced, more complex history to that event of population movement and almost replacement in the Arctic. And I think it just gives us a more complex understanding of population dynamics. And those kinds of stories, I think, could be played out in a variety of different geographic areas. One of our earlier studies in looking at a variety of different ancient DNA studies in North America that had been conducted, we were able to determine that there's clear geographic structure, that is, geographic patterns of variation in mitochondrial DNA among North American indigenous populations, and we see those same geographic patterns in the ancient DNA material, which suggests and illustrates that the geographic patterning that we see in modern populations is actually quite old. Those patterns were established fairly early, several hundred to maybe upwards of 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and that begins to allow us now to ask new and different questions about the nature of population structure and population dynamics at those times in the past that would have led to that kind of geographic structure. So it hasn't overturned anything that we thought we knew, but it's allowed us to ask more refined questions about prehistoric populations.
Now, when you do these studies on either contemporary or prehistoric populations, what kinds of genetic technologies do anthropologists rely on? Could you discuss how some of these techniques are actually employed to address specific questions in anthropological genetics?
Sure. Anthropological geneticists use the same kind of technologies that other geneticists and molecular biologists use. We use PCR and DNA sequencing and cloning and a variety of new and developing statistical approaches, statistical and population genetic analyses that is part of the power of the new genetic information, phylogenetic and bioinformatic methods. In our ancient DNA lab, we target specific components and sequences in mitochondrial DNA. We amplify them with PCR. Sometimes, depending upon the application, we sequence them directly for comparison either of ancient samples to modern samples to assess ancestral descendant relationships, or we may screen for discrete markers, restriction site polymorphisms, or insertion and deletion polymorphisms to look at frequency differences across populations and across time. But the same kind of laboratory methods that would be used, I think, in most genetic labs.
See. Now, in an editorial in the journal Human Biology, Sarah Williams-Blangero wrote that the Human Genome Project has opened a new frontier in anthropological genetics. What do you think she meant by new frontier?
Well, I can't speak for Sarah, but to me, when I read that, I felt it referred to really the incredible increase in the number and diversity of genetic markers we can now really economically obtain from samples. That sequence gives us a benchmark against which we can assess variation throughout the genome, not being limited to specific regions that are, you know, associated with specific coding genes or something. We can, the whole of the genome is now available for us to assess variation and patterned variation, and that's a power that we haven't had in the past, and it really allows us, I think, to be much more creative in the way we ask questions about how the genetic structure of populations informs us about history, about disease risk, about growth and development, population dynamics, a whole host of things. To me, that's what it meant.
Okay. Now, at Genetic Engineering News, we're strongly focused on biopharmaceuticals and the technologies used in biotech research. How has anthropological genetics contributed to our understanding of the interplay between genes and disease within various human populations around the world?
Well, I suppose to some degree anthropological geneticists are involved in the enterprise of studying human variation and human adaptability in a general sense, but many are also interested in the genetics of specific phenotypes, oftentimes related to disease phenotypes. So they're engaged in identifying genes that affect risk to disease. Oftentimes, I think this is through the study of quantitative traits, which anthropologists have been interested in and have studied for a very long time. But many of these quantitative traits are now known to influence risk to disease, for example, obesity, body mass index, things like that, and identifying genes in different populations that contribute to those quantitative traits and hence to disease risk, I think, is one of the contributions that anthropological geneticists not only can make but have been making, as well as development of statistical genetic methods for assessing disease risk from continuous quantitative genetic characters that have long been studied by anthropologists. I should also point out that anthropological geneticists have also been involved in identifying genes involved in growth, development, and aging across human populations, indeed across the whole of the primate order, and those may also be related to patterns of health and illness in important ways.
So my final question would be, what does anthropological genetics have to offer in terms of assisting, say, scientists involved in new drug development with the goal of ultimately improving human health?
That's a tough question. It's a bit beyond my own area of expertise, but I think the contributions may be made in documenting different distributions of risk factors, including genetic risk factors for specific disease phenotypes cross-culturally. This, too, might include studies of growth and aging differences across populations that contribute to patterns of health and illness. So I would think it's bringing the cross-cultural perspective to differential risk to disease, perhaps.
I'm John Sterling, editor of Genetic Engineering News, and I want to thank you for listening to our Gen podcast with Dr. Dennis O'Rourke. I'd also like to invite you to give your opinion on some of the issues raised during the podcast. Please go to Blog Biotech at www.genengnews.com/blog and respond to the following questions. Are significant numbers of genomics-based drugs being discovered and moving into the clinic based on the study of the human genome? If not, why? And besides biology, chemistry, and anthropology, are there any other academic disciplines that are making, or should be making, significant contributions to improving our understanding of the human genome and its potential to improve human health? For the GenCast Network, bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, be sure to visit our website at www.genengnews.com. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next Thursday.